Hello, you trapaholics out there, and all you meat hunters, and fishermen, and outdoorsmen, and basically just freaks of modern-day civilization. Welcome to Trapping Radio. This is your host, Clint Locklear. We're going to do a show where I'm answering a bunch of questions today. I haven't done this in quite a while, and I've got a bunch built up on my email, so I'm going to be picking these, and then hopefully it'll help. I want to remind everybody that I'm going to be in Mississippi next weekend at the Bass Pro. You can get all the information you want off the Mississippi Trappers Association. Chip Davis, which y'all know from Expandapans, is really trying to bump up Mississippi as far as their association goes, and I've never heard of one being in a Bass Pro. If nothing else, it's going to be an air conditioning. But I'm expecting to be a pretty good turnout from some southern trappers, and we're going to meet a lot of people that's probably going to have a lot of questions about what we're doing. So it should be a pretty good time. I do want to mention the sponsors. We have Hilltop Outdoors, which is our newest sponsor, and you can get pretty much all my stuff on there, and he's got a ton of stuff, and he's a member of the Trapping Brigade, the Fur Brigade, the Trapping Radio Fur Brigade, excuse me. You can get him on Amazon, Bonanza, Hilltop Outdoors, Funky Trap Tags and Supplies, and eBay, and probably some more that I don't even know about. He's really big on the internet. So if you used to shop in those places, that's where you can pick him up. F&T, Fur Harvesters, everything you need for hunting and trapping. And for hounds, they're kind of like the Cabela's of trapping, as far as if you need it, they've got it. Great service, great people. They've been one of the original sponsors that we had. Oki Cable and Trap Supply out of Oklahoma. Jeb does a great job. He likes working deals, so if you're into that horse trading side of getting supplies, give him a shot. He will probably be willing to work with you a little bit. Just a super guy in Oklahoma, and he's got a lot of supplies too. And then Jeff Dunlap, the death dealer himself and his lures, is a sponsor. Makes great lures, good friend of mine. And you know, if you're into the Facebook thing a lot, Trappers Talk is the biggest trapping group on Facebook, and Jeff kind of heads that up. So check him out there, and you can get his lures from a lot of different places, and Wildlife Control Supplies out of Connecticut. Those guys got everything you need to catch anything that walk, crawls, or flies in an ADC business. Plus, they have a lot of trapping lures and regular trapping supplies. So that's our sponsors. Give them a chance when you're looking around to buy stuff, because they really help out keep the show on the radio. Now, I'm going to go over a few things that I've noticed that I just want to talk about off the top of my head. One of them is I'm starting to get reports back from people that used the hammer a lot last year. The hammer's a coyote lure that I've got. What they're seeing now is when they use it in the fall and winter, and they go back and they're starting looking their lines over, animals are still digging where the hammer was 6-8 months later. I'm bringing that up. They had really good catches with it, but if it's staying that long in nature, guys, do yourself a favor. Now, if you're high rolling somewhere and you're just, you know, gunning out somewhere and rolling and taking the cream of the crop and moving on, I don't know if I'd really worry about it. But if you're trapping in the same area over and over and over again, or you're a predator control group guy, a predator control guy that's going back to the same places, I would take the effort with the hammer to put it on cotton or wool, and when you pull that line, take that cotton and wool with you. So you can soak it up with a hammer, and then you can put it in there and then take it with you. Because what we don't want to have happen, because it's lasting so long at the set, which is great because you can leave sets out for a couple months and not have to worry about it, but it's lasting so long that you don't want to get the coyotes habituated to that smell. So over a couple of years, it's probably going to lose its focus. So if you can take it with you, get creative that way, and I would definitely recommend that. Now, one of the first questions I've got comes from Canada, and I find this interesting that it's, I see this a lot with what how people look at things, and I think it's, as he says in here, or am I overthinking this a little bit? Clint, I wanted to try your bait enhancer. He's talking about my tactical nuke to pre-bait coons up here in Saskatchewan. We have no melons or persimmons up here at all. So in your opinion, which flavor would you use? Or am I thinking this and either one would do fine? Or am I overthinking this and either one would do fine? Yeah, they would both do fine. The persimmons and the melon, no matter where you're at, raccoon's going to be all over it. That is, if you want to really pre-bait a lot of coon, it's going to be hard to meet that. I need to get those up on my site. I'm not sure if the melon or the persimmon's on there, but it's smoked persimmon and a candied melon. And it's it trains the raccoons just like it does the deer with the tactical nuke for the deer, which is the pictures that I'm getting back from people on emails and what they're seeing when they're putting that stuff out for deer has been exceptional. And what we formulated for raccoons will do the same thing. So if you want to concentrate a bunch of coons in a single area, so when you go out and you set your traps, you don't have to run as far to catch as many coons. Just think about that. It didn't have to be used my product, but figure something out to be able to pre-bait them in. So I don't think it matters if it's been there or not. I mean, I'm selling the pawpaw tactical nuke for deer to places that they never had a pawpaw there unless someone brought it in on a truck. And they are tearing deer up with them as far as just getting them to come back and back and back and back. I think we as trappers and we as hunters a lot of times, we overthink things where it doesn't make a lot of sense. Because I promise you, if you were to bring lobster into a raccoon area in Tennessee where we have no lobsters, they would not hesitate one bit to get on it. It's not something that they have to be familiar with. It has to be something that trips their trigger where they can recognize it as it's going to be at least good enough to investigate and hopefully good enough to eat. So that's what you're looking for. It doesn't have to be something that's in your area. You know, you can, I've sold a lot of stuff over the years in places that there's just no way that they're used to those smells, and it just doesn't matter. So don't get wrapped up in stuff like that. You know, don't think about it so hard that you talk yourself out of a good product just because whatever's in it is not from your area. And not just from me, but from anybody else for that matter. You know, just don't overthink it. Now, I want to talk about something a little bit before we get on some more questions that I'm just finding fascinating, guys. This is really cool stuff. Now, I don't know if you can get this book on audio if you're not a reader. If you're not a reader and you're into hunting and you're into meat trapping or fishing or how to preserve food or different ways to be able to handle your catch, you're a survivalist or you're a prepper, this is an amazing book. I'm about halfway through it and my mouth hangs open most of the time because it really challenges what we as civilized man thinks we need to be healthy. And I'm not going to try to pronounce the guy's last name because it almost looks French, but it's not, I don't think. And this book was written all the way up to, I think, the 1940s or 50s. A lot of it comes from when he was younger, when he was in 1912 up to 1930. He lived with Eskimos. The name of the book is The Fat of the Land, which actually comes out of the Bible, which is pretty interesting, which we'll get to in a minute. But The Fat of the Land. Now, what this guy, basically through years and years, he's an anthropologist, so he studies, you know, older people. And to go study older people, you go to places where there's older people, older societies in modern civilization, plus you check bones and teeth and hair samples, and you do all this other stuff, and you're looking at the historic way people used to do stuff. And he learned something along the way, because he's not a nutritionist, if they even had such a thing back then. He lived off strictly meat and fat for many years of his life. Now, the way I first heard about this was from Jordan Peterson talking about his daughter that does a thing called a carnivore diet. Nothing but meat, salt, and water. And she's got a bunch of medical problems and it's pretty much fixed them all as far as allergies and she gets really sick from a lot of different foods. She's very healthy. She's been doing it for quite a while. She's physically fit. She's very active. And that blew Joe Rogan away because that goes against what everything we've been taught. You got to eat your vegetables. You got to eat your fruit. Eat everything in moderation. If you eat too much meat, your kidneys are going to fail. You're going to be constipated. you're going to have vitamins and mineral deficiencies, you know, your liver's going to get fatty. All the stuff that we think is the way it is may not be the way that it really is, but it's the way that we really think that it is. You know, what's that old quote from Mark Twain? It's not what people don't know that makes them dangerous, it's what they think that know that makes them dangerous. And I'm not making any medical claims here at all, but this will literally blow you away. But there's a lot of reasons to, I think, for outdoorsmen to read this book. Now, he lived for sometimes a couple of years at a time on a complete meat diet, and that could be seals, whales, polar bears, caribou, some fish, but they didn't really eat any type of vegetables at all. And the Eskimos did eat some fruit that grew, kind of like blueberries, but they didn't even consider them food. They were just kind of like a treat. But that they didn't, the culture of the Eskimos didn't even consider plant matter nor a fruit a food. It was just something they liked the flavor of, and they would eat it when it was in season. They didn't try to dry them or do anything like that. It was just a treat, you know, a couple of weeks out of the year that they'd get to have something like that. Now, him being an anthropologist goes back in history a long way. Now, this is where this gets interesting. The book starts with him living with them, what they ate. They ate a lot of bone marrow. They ate a lot of fat. They ate meat. And all through the book, he uses this term, fat and lean. Now, what separates this from a high-protein diet or just a fat diet is it's not one or the other. Because when you hear anything in diet today, everybody's trying to get their little niche and their little way to write a book and to get their own following and all this. They're trying to find something new that they can find from a study and get somebody to get on board, and they tell their friends, and if it picks up, they can make $1 million on a book, and that's really the goal. Because they're looking for just something that's a little different. What this book did is he just followed what the natives in Canada and the Eskimos in Alaska and the Eskimos in Canada were actually eating. And he studied them historically. Now, when we see the pictures of Eskimos from before they started eating our food up there, they look fat. They've got round heads. They're from Mongolia originally. So they got round faces, kind of like Chinese, but it's not really Chinese, but it's close. So they got round. Then they wear these big seal clothes and polar bears and caribou skins and everything. It makes them look fat, but actually they sleep naked, so you could see if they were fat or not because he slept with them every night. They weren't fat. They actually weren't very plump, not near as much as even as what he says is New York City in 1912, the Eskimos were not near as fat as the Americans were in the city. So eating the fat and the meat didn't make you fat. He couldn't find one that's ever had a cavity in their teeth, not one. All the way, they've checked thousands of skulls and they've never found a meat-eating society to have a cavity. Which is crazy to me, because what have we heard our whole life? You know, clean teeth don't get cavities. You must, you know, brush and floss and dental pick and go to the dentist and get them cleaned where they scrape around with a metal thing and plaque and this, that, and the other. He said Eskimos never brushed their teeth, never used anything like that. They had nasty mouths compared to us, and not a single one of them ever had a cavity until they started eating white man food. They also can look at Iceland, where the Vikings and some Scottish and Irish migrated to that. They were living off of some beef, mostly mutton, sheep, and milk, very few vegetables at all, and they ate fish. That was their diet. That's not the way we think of a diet, because you gotta have your vegetables and your salad and your, you know, your potatoes and your meat and your dessert and your bread and your butter. They just ate meat. Could not find a cavity, could not find any sign of disease at all from these people. It's just astounding, because if you're like me, when you're reading it, you're like going, yeah, but you're going to get, yeah, but you're going to have, yeah, but, yeah, but, yeah, but. And it's not that way. And he goes through these very deep, they actually did studies with medical facilities, high-powered medical facilities, where they had a guard on them for a year. they didn't eat anything but meat, and all the medical community were all waiting around at the end to tear them apart, and they couldn't. But they still could not get past their own belief of what they believed, that you gotta have vegetables and you gotta have fruit. And guys, I'm not telling anybody out there to go try this diet. But one thing about this, and we'll probably have a rant on this, the way that we started eating grains in this country, the way that we did, it's almost just like the hype of global warming. I mean, it's identical. The fear, the way people just believed without knowing why, and they will take that to their grave while they believe. It's fascinating stuff. So it's not really a fat diet, and it's not really a meat diet. It's where you mix, like if you were going to get a beaver in a survival situation or just being camping somewhere and you caught a beaver, how would you eat it? You could cook the oil out of the tail, so you've got it in a bowl. Think about that, kind of like like you're eating lobster and you get the butter with it. And then as you're eating the tenderloin, every now and then you dip a piece down in that beaver oil. That's the way that these meat hunting societies ate meat, unless it was very fatty meat. And now most game animals are not super fatty. So that's what they were doing. But it's not a high protein. You're not eating, you know, like modern day pork where it's lean, and a bunch of filet mignons that have no fat in them, or the ultra lean cuts of meat. That's not what these people ate. It was about 80% calories coming from fat, and if you eat like sirloin steak and stuff like that, you're about 80% fat anyway just eating that. Or they would dip it in some type of oil, usually blubber or fat off the back of the tail or the kidney fat of an animal when they would skin it. It's just absolutely fascinating. Now, reason I want to bring this up, for one, I think it's a super lesson for people to read, because it'll make you really question what you think you know about diets. And when you see how the doctors are, you'll see that it's just like everything else. Nothing's changed. But it makes you really question what it is. It used to be that if you had acne before Keys brought in the food pyramid, every doctor knew how to get a kid off of acne. Put him on a meat diet. Goes away. Amazing. No drugs, no hormones, no all this craziness that they give kids. Put them on meat, it clears up. Someone's on that's diabetic, put them on a meat diet, it goes away. So the cure for acne and diabetes is scientifically proven with historical basis that a diet somewhere around that 70 to 80% fat and the other part being meat, which makes it not high protein, cures a lot of the ills. You have stronger bones, you don't have the cavities, you don't have the hair loss that we have. All the stuff that we kind of consider normal makes you question what normal really is and what we're doing. So that's the reason I think it up. Survivalists miss this point all the time. Like I did a series on YouTube that you can look up, and it's called Survival is Mostly Mental Masturbation, because that's what it is. Because you got all these guys that want to go out and forage for stuff. And they have this idea of deer and, you know, snaring the mice and rabbits and stuff like that. People that actually lived in the woods, if you want to learn how you do something, learn from people that's actually done it, not someone that's just read books about it. So when you go to cultures that actually lived the way that people think they're going to be able to live, modern survivalists are very confused on what that is, because it is a scientific proven fact. If you shut the fat off from a human being, he actually gets what they call fat poisoning, which is the opposite of having it. Your body shuts down. Like you can look at people that try to do these week and 2 week things where they just eat survival food and fish and forage, and I've talked about that before. The reason they were starving to death, it wasn't because of the calories, it was because of what they were eating didn't have any fat in it. And it didn't matter how much they ate. Fat is what actually makes a human being work. But survivalists miss this. They think that they can go out and forage for some grasses and dandelions and plantains. And, well, if you figure out a calorie of a day, you'll need about a bushel basket of that, and you'll crap yourself to death, so you won't be hungry, so I guess it'll work out for you. But you won't be able to survive a long time. Most people are going into survival almost as, can I just slow down my starvation a little bit? Well, that seems like a crappy way to look at survival. But a lot of people are. But if you're into that type thing, get the book. It'll blow you away. It'll show you how they took apart caribou, which is a lot like our whitetail, how they got the fat from those. Interestingly enough, the back straps that we all love, that was dog food. There wasn't any fat in there. Why would a human waste his time eating that? Now, we put fat on it with butter, and we marinate it, and we do all this stuff. But to them, it didn't make any sense for a human to eat it. That was dog food. So what our historical healthy ancestors thought was good and what we think is good is so backwards, it's amazing. So just think about this a little bit. Now, what really blew me away is I grew up Baptist. I went to a Christian school from about, I think it was third to the eighth grade, and then I ended up going to a Christian school when I was a senior. So I didn't go to Christian school, but went to church, especially when we were Baptist, little as like 22 days out of a 7-day week. So we was there all the time, always reading about the Bible. But the fat of the land comes from the Bible. And when you look historically at like Cain and Abel, the reason God didn't do his vegetables, it wasn't because it was vegetables, it was because it wasn't even considered worthy of being sacrificed to God. Only the fat was. That's where all that got started. And the kind of the joke in the book was, that's why vegetarians are still pissed off today about the vegetables and the meat eating, is because the first time they tried it, God slammed them himself. And then you look at different things in the Bible. It talks about eating fat in several different places, talking about the goodness. It seems to me, because what the book does is it goes through all of the Old Testament, talking about the way that people ate and what was sacrificed and what was considered good and all this. And you look at the Greeks, and you look at Iceland, and you look at Scotland, and you look at different places that had this lifestyle, it almost seems like adult people ate fatty meat, wine, and mead. That was their diet. The only other thing in there that would be different is when they had fish heads and everything, they would make soups out of the fish head, and they would eat all the marrow out of the bones, and they would make basically a bone broth, kind of like a stew that they would drink. So the meat, the bone broth, the mead, and the wine was pretty much what people lived on with no health problems. They were bigger than we were, than we are now, which most people don't want to believe that, but you can look at the records and see it. They were obviously much stronger at the time. A bowman, back in the day, we get fired up when people think about a bow. 80 pounds is a big draw. They were so strong back in the day that they were pulling back bows that were 190 pounds to the point that it would deform their bones because their muscles became so strong. What did they eat? Fatty meat and sweet honey wine, which is mead, by the way. Very healthy for you. Now, the last thing I'm going to say about this is not only is the teeth and the bones and the muscle and the all the diabetes and all of the mental issues we have today with children, with being Alzheimer's and Asperger's and all that stuff that's just common now, multiple sclerosis, all that's very new. None of these other people had that, but from a man's point of view, a man used to be 4 times the man of today. The optimum testosterone on an average of a male today in his mid-20s is about 800. The average male in America today, then that 800 is optimal, the average male in America today is less than 200. The testosterone of men that lived off meat and mead and honey and bone broth. That's what they ate. They were not gardeners. They did not eat cereals or grains. They had four times the testosterone of a modern day man. You want to know, when we look at the, you know, look at the historical movies, those guys were the toughest things walking the face of the earth. Oh my, how could they survive that? Because they were four of us. But we're the smart ones. Just something to think about. Why do you believe what you believe about food? And can you actually go and look at it? Because everything I'm telling you is scientifically proven with studies from scientists. It's just that our culture refuses to go down this path because we've been taught that fat is bad, grain is good, vegetables are best, a little bit of meat, cut down on your fats, you know, all this type of stuff. The book will freak you out if you read it. Then you can make the decision on what to do. To me, it seems like it's that would be an extreme way to eat today. But there's actually a lot of people today doing it. Carnivore diet is kind of what the modern version of this is. And people are doing it for a lot of health reasons and just sickness reasons and different things like that. And people aren't falling over dead with all the stuff that people think that you're going to have. So just think about that a little bit. Now, I got this. Now, y'all guys listen to the rant where I was talking about, are you a Ferrari or a dump truck? And Travis comes in at the end of it and I ask him what he wanted to be. And he says a Ferrari because you get the ladies. Now, as soon as I turned off the recorder, it became clear to me that that was really the right answer for Travis. He's 21 years old. Nothing else in the world exists except for maybe deers, hot rods, and girls. So that was the right answer. But I got this from Jesse, which I thought would be fun to read. I just finished and listened to your last rant. Travis' comment made me laugh. He needs to understand a Ferrari may get ladies, but what kind of ladies? A shallow one who's probably a brat who needs a woman. He needs a woman that wants a man who has a dump truck. Not drives, but has his own. If the right woman sees a man who owns his dump truck and he's hauling rock or whatever his own business, shows he's a self-employed guy, because if anyone and any business owner or entrepreneur, they are not satisfied with the standard quo. So he's adventurous because he's willing to take risk and can provide. A real mature woman is way hotter than some girl to me, at least. And she respects a man a lot more than a boy. Just my 2 cents worth. Travis seems like a great guy. He'll figure it out. Keeping working on it. I agree with you. At our age, Jesse, yes. At 21, I don't think he's worried about the right girl. He's just worried about a girl, you know. So Ferrari's probably the right answer, but you made some really good points. What kind of woman would you get with that? Okay. My name is Ryan. I'm a trapper in Ohio. I'll be going out of state to trap as soon as I can get permission around a family member in Indiana. I've also considered trapping in Alaska. On Trapping Radio, you talked about trapping in Alaska when in the military. My question to you is, how did you get a partial to trap in Alaska? Is it given out by the government or can you get private land permissions? Also, I don't have any proof of this, but I would guess that there isn't much fur because there isn't much food and winter is intense and very long. So is there much fur there? And if there isn't, does this qualify? See, if it isn't, does this qualify a fur offset the small amount of fur? Thank you for your help, Ryan. Ryan, Alaska's its own thing. I mean, kind of like Canada's its own thing. Alaska's definitely its own thing. I'm sure there is private ground up there. I don't know of anybody that owns a lot of private ground, but there is a lot of ranchers. I don't know if they lease it for the government or whatever it was. I'm going to tell you how I trapped. And I got in trouble with a trapper up there, mostly because I reacted the way he reacted to me trapping, because I didn't understand the illegal rules of Alaska. When I was in the military, behind every base, like Fort Wainwright or Richardson or Greeley, you got these big areas that are attached to the bases for training. during the season, you can claim a section of that for trapping. It's just common enough up there that that's part of the rules. I don't think you're going to pull that off at Campbell or Bragg, but you could up there because a lot of people trapped. So you would go in and you would sign up for, like, you know, section 24A, you know, and that would give you a certain amount of ground, and that's what I did. I had one of those behind Greeley, and I had one of those behind Fort Wainwright, because they weren't massively big, but there was enough fox and marten and stuff like that to make it worth my while. And then I would just go down the road so I could find somewhere I could pull off the side of the road, and I would just take off with snowshoes because it is government land. And I would run these marten traps and catch some fox. But when I got really close to somebody else's trap line, he started taking all my traps and left cards, and then I went up there ready to kick somebody's butt because he took my traps. And he explained to me how it worked. Up there you have registered trap lines. These registered trap lines are not, like, law legal. It's just accepted up there. And you don't really want to break it because you may need some trappers up. Very different up there than it is down here with competition. So you may have a 150-mile loop going out through the middle of nowhere, and that's your trap line. And you bought that from somebody that ran it for 20 years, and they bought it from somebody that ran it for 20 years. And it's almost considered like common law, but I don't think anybody can go to jail over crossing someone's trapping rights up there. You can buy or rent somebody's trap line, and they'll be cut for snowmobiles and stuff. Just going up there for a week or two, I'm not sure that's worth it. But it's not something that you're just going to be able to like go to New Mexico or Arizona and it's just public. Because in Arizona, New Mexico, you don't have registered trap lines the way they are up there. But if you get a hold of the Alaskan trappers, you may very easily find some older guys that have some trap lines. You could throw them some coin and then go up there and use their, maybe their cabins, maybe even their traps, use their trails. I don't know if they'd let you use their snow machines or not, but you'd have to work that out. I don't know if a civilian can get behind one of the bases the way that I did, because I never really thought about that before. You can do the rogue manner, which I did, was just going off in snowshoes, but unless you're used to that climate and you're physically fit and used to Alaska, not sure that's the smartest, because if you get in trouble, they'll probably find you in the spring, what's left of you. But at the time, that's what I was doing in the military anyway. So to me, a 10-mile snowshoe loop for marten and fox was like, you know, morning PT. It wasn't like it was a big thing. I was very used to snowshoes. I was very used to, you know, an average of 20 below zero. I was in great shape. I was really stupid. I didn't think anything could happen to me, and it worked out for me. If you're from Ohio and think because you get cold in Ohio that Alaska's the same, you're going to the opposite ends of the earth as far as what reality is. So just if you're going to go up there, be safe. I think the smartest way is to try to rent someone's trap line for the year. I don't know how easy that is. I don't know where it would be. You may have to get flown in. There's all kind of craziness that goes on up there. But just to go up there to trap for a couple of weeks, it's going to take a lot of planning. But Ryan, if that's what you've got your heart set on, I have no doubt you can pull it off. This is an interesting one. This is from also Orion. My fiance recently bought a house cat for us, and I really couldn't help but think of bobcats. In Ohio, maybe it is the same, Ryan. We don't have bobcats, but I could learn how a bobcat reacts to something from watching a house cat? ? Absolutely. Absolutely. There's no difference. For example, a flashy dirt hole or fancy cubby. Also, could I use the turds in place of the turds in, turds in my O'Gorman Mafia set for coyotes and fox, or would it draw too much attention? No, absolutely. Ryan, you can, without a doubt, use house cat turds Is it going to be as good as a cow? I don't know, in a mafia set. But none's going to step on it, and it's not going to scare a cow off, and it's really not going to be that out of the way. They smell all kind of stuff throughout their daily life as far as different droppings from different animals. And it will definitely, in a mafia set, keep them from stepping where you don't want them to step. So, yeah, I mean, I've used them. I mean, I've got house cats, so I couldn't tell any difference about that. If it does draw too much attention, can I throw them in a clump of grass for a flat set or down a dirt hole for curiosity? Yep, absolutely. When it comes to trapping, man, it's pretty much, when it comes to cats especially, just keep them controlled. Don't let them wander around, but do whatever you want to do and just test stuff out. You're not going to freak out a cat. The only way you're going to freak out a cat is if you're still standing there and you start running at it or something. Nothing in nature, nothing you're going to do is going to freak out a cat. My last question, can I dump a bunch of house cat turds out in a spot to make a feral cat toilet? Absolutely. This happens a lot in the West. I've done it here in Tennessee. I clean out the kitty litter box. I will sift out the scat. And I will find places that are convenient for me to check, that I know bobcats are close, and I will put those out. They don't all hit, but a lot of them do. And to this day, they're still being used as cat toilets. Once that gets started, unless those cats die and the cats that find it die, it's always going to be something they're going to check out. And a feral cat will get that started just as good as bobcats will, at least in my experience. Do feral cats have cat toilets like bobcats? Yes. We've got Frederick Douglass, which is a stray that we picked up here, which is a black cat that stays outside. His rapper name is Freddie D. And I've watched him very closely. He's got, that I know of, and I'm sure there's more, but he's got four places that he craps in every day. And he'll pee in them and crap in them. Two are in my yard, two are across the street in the woods. He follows me around like a dog when I'm doing the ducks and chicken in the garden and going out to the lure shop and stuff like that. And so I get to see him a lot, and he's very regimented on where he goes to the bathroom. Unfortunately, one of them's in my wife's rose garden, and she doesn't really like it. The other one is, interesting enough, outside on the edge of where our lure shop is. Then the other two that I know of are across the street, just where there's some grown up woods. He stays and makes this route every day. I can do it almost with a stopwatch unless I'm out there doing something that's distracting him. But if I'm working in the office in here and I can see out the window, I can tell you about what time he's going to start heading down the driveway. He's going to take a right, he's going to go through those woods, and he's going to come out at the neighbors and come back down the road and come back up the driveway. Same way that especially a female bobcat is. Because, do feral cats, yes. Because if they do use feral cats, let's see. Do feral cats have cat toilets like bobcats? Yes. Because if they do, I can use the feral cats for a staked house cat set. Yes, as long as it's dead. I mean, if it's, you know, like roadkill or something like that. Steak cat with a tail sticking up and a couple of paws, yeah. I mean, that's old school there, but definitely will work. I'm mildly allergic to it, so I might as well use it to my advantage somehow. Appreciate any info on this subject that you have. Yeah, you can really watch. I mean, when we come in making cat collector, I have got to put a pants on, or if I sit down at the couch even after a shower, I've got to put a blanket over me, or my male cat will claw me to pieces. The female cat will actually rub on me to the point that she drools like a drunk person. And she'll get all over me when I'm doing that. It's very interesting. One of the cats gets really turned on by catnip, and the other one could care less. And the outside cat can care less because he's around it all the time, because we grow it and we actually use it in some of our lures, so he's around it all the time. House cats are tremendous teachers. for someone to watch and learn from a bobcat. Now, I hope Cody doesn't get mad at me about this, because I don't think there's anything commercially he's looking to do with this, but it's very interesting. It's Cody from Maine. I'm listening to an old show the other day, and you mentioned that if you could put a portable pocket on a drag, that it would be an ultimate system. What I've got thinking about and remembered that I have a ton of railroad tie plates. So I cut a piece of pipe and welded it to it. I'm going to run some like the one in the picture, which is what the picture is. If you think of a tie plate, if you lay it flat on one side and you got the two ridges that come up on the other side, he's laid the pipe in there and just welded it. So it's just like a pipe welded onto a tie plate. Another modification I'm going to try is raising the pocket up off the plate a few inches. In Maine, that may be a good thing because of the snow that y'all guys have. Try it that way. I've seen how you set your pockets for coyotes, and I was thinking this would be a good way to mimic that. The only downside of these I see right now is they are heavy. Yes, they are. But if they work, I think it would be a very functional system to use. I know you're a systems guy and thought you might like this idea. If you have any input, that would be awesome. Thanks, Cody. I think it's genius, to be honest with you. This is a full-size tie plate. It's got a piece of pipe, just like the portable pocket, so it's just a piece of pipe. I would, on the back side, weld a washer, though, Cody, to make sure there's only one way they can really get the bait or lure out. But you still get the air movement. Depending on where you're at, like if you're in the really thick woods of Maine, and you put like 14 foot of chain on this tie plate, there ain't a coyote going nowhere in those woods. He will go a long way in an open field with a tie plate by itself. But I'm wondering how awkward it would be if you were to hook, you know, like take some half inch rebar and bend them around in a couple of weird ways. So if it starts going through the woods or whatever, and then you can actually bend the points down so it's like in the ground. So whichever way it's going, it's kind of like a spider web type thing, a spider legs. So whichever way it's going, it'll help leave some marks. Because if this does get on grass or something like that, there's a good chance you won't be able to follow it. So it could be something as simple as, you know, putting some 16 penny nails and weld to the bottom just so it like goes over it like a big thing of knife sandpaper or something. That might work pretty good. Or with some hooks going out to the side, if it did get close to a tree, it would hook up on it. I think it's a great idea. The beauty of this is if you weld a lap link to this thing, wherever your best locations are, every year you just kind of find a place to set them aside where no one's going to run over them or a tractor's not going to get them. No one's going to see it from a road if you're in the woods. Then all you would have to do every year is come up and clip to your lap link with your chain, and then have your trap on the chain. Throw your lure in there, throw some grass on top of it, and run like a banshee. Over time, you could probably get out 250 of these in a day. That's going to be some fun checking. Because that was so much faster than anything else. Especially if you've got leaves to set in and peat moss and or grass clippings. You're not doing a lot of piddling around at the set. I think it's ingenious to do what you've done. I haven't thought of it that way. I was thinking about just putting a small pipe where it wouldn't get caught up on the drag itself. It's kind of what I was thinking myself, Cody. But this is actually pretty slick. It would also be a definite raccoon killer. Oh, you do got a washer on the back. Yeah, man, I'd say roll with it. Let us know how that worked out for you. I will definitely be curious about how that works. Now, this is from Mr. Moore, and I can't believe that somehow I didn't answer this earlier, just quickly back, so I'm going to go and do it now. I've been watching your permaculture videos on YouTube, and I also want to know what your opinion is on using wood chips, mulching the garden to help build soil. I have an unlimited supply of these. If it's good to use. Thanks, CJ. I know this isn't trapping, guys, but it won't take but a second. Absolutely, man. The trick to using wood chips and hay and peat and all that, put it on top of the ground. Let nature take care of it. Don't till it in. Don't dig it in. Don't do anything. Just stack it on there. If it's really green like this year it's cut, find you some chicken litter in the winter. Put some on top of it so the nitrogen kind of goes down through there. You don't have nitrogen depletion that way. If it's old, you're not going to have nitrogen depletion. If it's just cut this year, you'll need to add some nitrogen. Chicken litter's cheap. If you've got duck, just pour the duck water on there several times to do that. If you don't have any excess to that, you need to have some type of nitrogen if you're going to put it on more than just a couple inches thick. Because what it'll do, it'll suck the nitrogen, the bacteria in the soil out, and then it'll make your plants look yellow. So if you start seeing that, just start adding nitrogen. It'll straighten itself back out. It's just the bacteria and all that stuff going on is what's going on. But absolutely, you got it, brother. Use it. And if you got places that you're not right up next to plants, you can have that a foot thick. In 2 or 3 years, you'll be really glad that you did. Okay, this is from Shane. How's it going? I hope all is well with you and yours. I have a question about beaver snares and snaring. I was listening to an episode of Trapping Radio the other day when you were talking about running snares for a beaver on pickets or form stakes. This system sounds like it'd be perfect for my conditions down here in Louisiana and in Mississippi floodplain. Yes, it will. We have mud banks, and more mud banks, and I do a lot of boat trapping. After hearing the episode on Trapping Radio, I referred to the Art of Professional Beaver Control, and it seems like your system for running the form stakes evolved some over the years. They have. I would like to build or purchase about 20 dozen or so beaver snares, and I want to be sure to get set up as described as a radio episode. Okay. I don't want to get confused here, so I'm going to start with the snares. They're really simple. You can go with 3/32, 7x7. I don't think it's as good, but it'll work. 5/64, 1x19 is my snare cable of choice for beaver. In any situation, you know, you can go down to 1/16 if you treat it a certain way, but let's not go there on this. 5/64, 1x19 is like the perfect of everything for beaver. The way in the book that you saw where I had the loop that would open up to about a 9 or 10 inch loop, you will need that 10 inch loop in the floodplain, Mississippi and Louisiana. The beaver are really big. You'll have to open those loops up probably to the 10 inch, but still give yourself 2 inches off the ground because it'll help you catch more beaver. Where your lock is and where you have your tubing, right behind that goes a swivel. It can be a snare swivel or a barrel swivel, like a heavy one for fishing, or a trap swivel off a trap if you got some of those laying around. You just want it to really swivel. And then you're going to run the pigtail down because you're not going to be able to buy it this way for a picket, so you'll have to cut the end off. But if you go to somebody that builds snares and let them know what you're doing, you'll just have to cut the end of the stop off and put a new stop on there. But from that swivel back, you only need it to be the length of your picket plus about another 10 inches. That's all you need for this type of snare for a beaver. So if you're using 2 foot pickets, it's 2 feet plus 10 inches. That's from the swivel back. So you got your loop, your swivel, then your pigtail. That's the part that goes down. Now, just any good lock will work. Micro locks, slim locks, cam locks, washer locks will work on beaver. You can get really complicated with it. You will want to have a piece of rubber tubing because you don't get that cold where you're at. Don't worry about getting a whammy or anything. And that's really what you need for the snares. Now, if you order these, order them the way I described it. So you're gonna have to measure what a 10-inch loop is, plus your lock, plus your tubing, and then where you're going to hook up a double ferrule on your, to actually close that behind the whammy. I've never measured my snares. I just always make a pattern, and I just repeat that over and over again. So I can't tell you that like it's a 42-inch, piece of cable. You know, you'll have to make one yourself. You can use string or whatever to figure that out. But I don't have a number because I've never done it that way. And then, if you're using a 2 foot picket, that 2 feet plus about 10 inches, so you can get the lock up in the air where you want it, because you're going to be anchoring to the bottom of the form. Beaver snares don't have to be complicated. You know, the more you get into it, you'll tweak it here and there, but don't overcomplicate the beaver snare. But if you're going to order them with that extra pigtail for the 2 feet for the picket and the 10 inches to get it up in the air, they're going to have to put a stop on that or it's going to start unwinding. So what you'll have to do is order it without a loop or something, cut the stop off the end, run it through, and add another stop when you run it through your picket, if you're not making them yourself. I have a pile of 2 foot forming stakes. I believe you're drilling two holes at the same level at the top of the stake for the support, and then a hole halfway down or near the bottom for the snare. That is true. I was wondering if you could clarify in what situation it would be better to anchor the snare in the middle hole versus the bottom hole. Also, when building the snare, how much total length would you recommend and how far from the loop to the trap swivel? That would be about 10 inches is all you'll need. Well, go and give yourself 12, 13 inches just for a little play. It's go with it that way. Guys, I'm not scientific when I make snares. I just make a pattern and I repeat. I'm very caveman when it comes to that. Now, in places that I've got very hard clay ground, you don't have to take that all the way to the bottom. So that's the difference you're seeing in the videos and the books. If I'm on a muddy river, I want... So what he's saying, guys, if you don't know what this is, imagine a form picket stake. You know, it's flat on top and it's pointed. You know, that's what they form up concrete and do all kind of stuff with. If you get a 2 foot one and you're in Louisiana, I would recommend, unless you're in some type of crazy, you know, white clay or something like that down there, about 2 inches from the bottom, drill a hole, and that's where your snare is going to go through. Then you're going to have a washer and then the stop on the back of the snare. There's no need for a loop. The reason it's at the bottom, if a beaver breaks the picket, it spins in the ground and acts just like a wolf fang. So it acts like a disposable if the stake breaks. A lot of times, the reason in very clay ground, I would have it more towards the middle because sometimes the picket would break before I could get it all the way in. But it was, you know, red clay is so tight that it would still hold, and if the beaver broke what was left, again, I'd have a disposable stake. So that's why it's on the bottom or top. In softer stuff like Louisiana, at least everywhere I've been in Louisiana, I would put it towards the bottom. Now, the two holes that are towards the top, again, I've never really measured these. I just come down about an inch and drill a hole, and I go underneath about that an inch, and I drill a hole. That way I can take my number 9 wire and run it through one and run it back through. So when I beat the stake in the ground with the hammer, the soil tightens up that number 9 wire and gives me a very rigid support system. That's really all this is. It's a very, very simple system. The beauty of it for a boat is you can get 5 or 6 milk crates and stack these things up. And you'll learn how you put your snare support wire, you bend it back over the picket, and then you use the snare itself to wrap that together and then, you know, secure it back with a loop end. And you can stack these straight up and down in a box of a milk crate or a tote or something. And you can literally go out and simply by pulling up with a boat and, you know, because I'd always have a ring on the boat. So I'd go up to a beaver slide. I would cut the motor. I would glide up. And as the boat's about to hit the bank, I'm walking from the back to the front. And I've got a long T-bar that I will slide down through a ring that's on the front of the boat. So it pins the boat right where it is. I can reach over. I've got my hammer, which is always going to be where my right hand can grab it right off the deck. I can kind of lay down on the front of my John boat. Right on the left-hand side up towards the front is whatever tote or milk crate I'm using for the snare pickets themselves. So I'm grabbing the hammer with one hand and I'm grabbing the pickets with the other. I can open that snare loop and kind of flip it. Everything comes undone. And then I just reach up If I can't push it in with my hand, I need the hammer on the side of a river. I put it right next to the slide, two or three hits with a hammer. My snare support is rigid. I open the loop to the size that I want. I stick it on the piece of rubber tubing going to the number nine wire, that's the support wire off of the picket. I pull up my T-bar and I kick back. Now, if I'm using lure, right before I pull the boat loose, I just sling some lure a couple of feet behind the snare. That's all I do. You can put those out so fast. If you've got a partner, you can put out beaver snares in less than 15 seconds. And I'm talking good quality beaver snares. What I did like about them is it worked really good for coon, red fox, gray fox, and I'd have to have it a little bit longer if I was also going to be snaring cats. But so if I'm putting in beaver snares and I'm in a boat and I see the high trail, the high game trail is right there close to where I'm at, I can step out of the boat, grab two of them right on both sides of the beaver slide. I can beat them in, open it up for the animal that I want, say raccoons or fox. Do this, repeat the same thing. So when I pull up with the boat, before I stake it, I can look and see if anything's caught on the high bank and see if I got a beaver in the low bank. If not, I just kind of push off with the paddle and go to the next one. You talking about system? This is a system for beaver snaring unless you're in rocky ground. I've only had one beaver ever pull this, and that was on a sugar sandbar that was very new after a big flood here in Marion County, just south of me. And I kind of knew that I shouldn't have left it there when I set it. But I've had such a good luck with this holding. The wood swells up. It gets very hard to get out. They're really kind of disposable. You either catch or you just kind of cut your snare and your support wire off and use it somewhere else. Because a lot of times they're really hard to get out. I'd rather be catching fur than pulling equipment. But that's up to you on how you actually do that. So the last thing I want to talk about, guys, it's getting really close to trapping season. Really close. Prepare for what is about to happen. Be the CEO of your own trapping enterprise when you're going out. What I mean by that is get your vehicle and boats ready. Really think about what you need to check. Get your oil changed. Get your bearings greased. Check your fluids. Check your tires. Do you need new tires? Do you need spares? Do you know where your jack is at? Do you have a way to repair a tire when you're on the trap line? What's going to happen if you have a flat tire? Work all this out ahead of time. Check your air cleaners. Start thinking about organization. Do you need to buy some new totes? Build some wooden boxes? How are you going to have traps and animals? Is it all going to be a big bloody mess together? Or are you going to have a way for it to drain? Whatever your vehicle is, think all that out. Are your windshield wipers in good condition? Normally, when I replace my windshield wipers before every trapping season, it's just a habit. Go ahead and get a tune-up. Do you need suspension modifications? Does it need to be jacked up? Does it need to be stiffer? You know, do you need wider tires because you're going to be in a lot softer sugar mud type stuff? Think about these things. Go ahead and do it before you get in trouble. I didn't do this for several years and I always got in trouble. So use my mistakes to learn. If you got a trailer, go ahead and grease up your bearings really good. Make sure the tires are in good, you know, shape. Make sure that the way that you hook it up, the chains, the lights work on the trailer, get all that. Make sure your tags and insurance are up to date before season starts. Don't be wasting your season going down to the courthouse and dealing with them. Get fixed what needs to be fixed. If your heater's not really working right, or like the older vehicles, they would start leaking and, you know, fogging up the inside of the thing, go and get it fixed before you really need it. If you're somewhere hot, get your air conditioning fixed if you need it. You know, if you like listening to the radio and your radio quit working, just get it fixed. Do your brakes need replaced? Be an adult about your vehicle. a lot of time gets wasted on trap lines because people just jump into it without planning for it. Your vehicle in a long season takes a lot of abuse and is used for a lot of miles, boats included, trailers sometimes, four-wheelers. Think about a four-wheeler the same way. You will sleep better going into the season if you know it's right. Make it right. Do the right thing. Be your own adult CEO of your own trapping empire this fall. And because there's no one else to blame, it's all on you. So take care of it to begin with. And for the guys that I will see in Mississippi, can't wait to meet you. And then I've got the Southern NTA after that. And then I'm done with conventions. I've got to go catch some shark and some redfish down in Florida to get that part of the freezer filled up and start working on some deer and some beaver and still doing a little bit of predator work here and there. And that's going to kick off in some different places. So I've got a lot going to be going on and I'm excited. I think it's going to be a good year. Travis says we're going to have a bad winter because he's noticed that the hornet's nests are being built up high in the trees. So if we don't have a bad winter, we're going to get on to Travis. But if we have a bad winter and it's, you know, bounced around that 0 degrees like we had 3-4 years ago for long periods of time, Travis will be the genius because he noticed what was going on with a hornet's nest. Okay, you trapaholics, y'all go have a good time. Do the right thing and just have fun, man. Life's too short not to have fun.